Rewatch Podcast presents The Naked Gun Rewatch. Join us for some bonus episodes as we revisit these films in a smaller film franchise. Send your feedback to the Rewatch Podcast at gmail.com. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/rewatchpodcast or follow us on Twitter at rewatchpodcast. Today we're discussing The Naked Gun 33 and a Third, The Final Insult, starring Leslie Nielsen, Priscilla Presley, George Kennedy, O.J. Simpson, Fred Ward, Anna Nicole Smith, and Weird Al Yankovic. Directed this time by Peter Siegel. Welcome back to the Rewatch Podcast. I'm Sergeant Corey Drebin, Detective Lieutenant Police Squad.
Yeah, and I'm Robert De Niro.
Mr. De Niro, we've got to get inside.
That's the first time we've ever done that, Corey.
Nice little skit.
I know, a nice little skit. Maybe we'll expand it next time. How are you, mate?
I'm fantastic, mate. Glad to be back talking Naked Gun.
Yes, the third one and the final one.
Yes, indeed. So let's get right into the trailer.
Let's do it.
When law-abiding citizens are forced to live in fear, we look for protection to one man. Lieutenant Frank Drebin is back. This time, he's going undercover in the big house.
Where's your prison number?
It's unlisted.
And playing the deadliest game of all.
The damn blue! I don't get your head out of my pocket!
But Police Squad desperately needs him back. Because a mad bomber is about to blow up Hollywood's biggest bash. And if anyone can stop him, so can Frank.
Hold on.
Sergeant Frank Drebin, Detective Lieutenant Police Squad.
Yeah, and I'm Robert De Niro.
Mr. De Niro, we've got to get inside.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to present the...
We're here to prevent a disaster.
You're too late for that.
That's the guy!
Starring Leslie Nielsen as Lieutenant Frank Drebin. Priscilla Presley as Jane. Anna Nicole Smith as Tanya. Fred Ward as Rocco.
Freeze and nobody gets hurt.
Well, from now on.
Anna Nicole Smith as Tanya. George Kennedy as Ed. O.J. Simpson as Nordberg. And introducing Anna Nicole Smith as Tanya.
Have you seen my pigeon?
Naked Gun 33 and a Third. The Final Insult. The movie that hits crime where it hurts. This picture contains mostly all new jokes. May play slightly funnier east of the Rockies.
Okay, welcome back. That was the trailer. Hope you enjoyed that.
Yes, very good.
All right, so how about you kick off the trivia this week?
Okay, trivia. This film was released March 18, 1994. Again, with the resurgence. Years in between.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What is the gap? I think it's 91 was 2.5. So, yeah, a reasonable gap, is it, especially considering the fact that the second film was a pretty big hit. So they certainly didn't kind of get this made all that quickly, did they?
No, and it's not as big a gap as what Police Academy had. I think they wrapped up their last one in, 1989 and then didn't come back till 94 again. So maybe 94 is a big year for attempting to return to these comedy series that people might still have in their memory and have been anticipating, but they're going to give it another go.
So this was going up against Mission to Moscow, was it?
Yeah. I think this one might have done a bit better.
Yeah, just slightly.
Maybe. The film made over $51 million domestically, and that more than exceeded its estimated $30 million production budget. So it made more than its budget back in its domestic.
You know what? For a silly comedy, this $30 million is quite a big budget, isn't it? Like, a lot of money got spent on this film.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the lowest grossing of the series, you know, even though it did make its budget back and everything. The other one still made a lot more than this one. But still, 33 and a Third did manage to grab the number one weekend box office title in the US during its opening weekend, as did the other Naked Gun film. So
this film wasn't considered a flop by any means. I mean, it was a reasonably successful kind of sequel. I mean, I can kind of understand them maybe not making any more after this, although I did read somewhere that there was kind of talk of maybe doing a fourth one like several years later, and for whatever reason it kind of didn't really get off the ground. But yeah, I mean, I think three is perfectly fine for this franchise.
Yeah, I read that trivia too. It was actually in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
That David Zucker and Pat Proff actually did write a script for a fourth Naked Gun movie with the working title, The Naked Gun 444.4. And it would have given Drebin a younger female sidekick. However, Zucker and Prof instead got involved in the Scary Movie franchise. They came in at Scary Movie 3 and then did a few more sequels after that.
So you're telling me that Drebin and Jane that their romance doesn't survive? Is that what you're saying, Corey?
I haven't seen Priscilla Presley in recent years. I imagine that she's like one of those desperate housewives full of Botox or something like that.
I'm not
saying that's what happened. That's just what I imagined happened with her.
I'm not quite sure why she stopped making films. I mean, I think we've spoken about this briefly before, but this was made in 94. And then after this film got released, she did a couple of like TV, like Melrose Place, Touched by an Angel. Apparently she appeared in Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, which I don't remember at all. And a couple of other things here and there. And don't misunderstand me. Like, she's not a ginormous star. She's not certainly bankable, but she's not nothing either. I mean, these films were reasonably big films. She was certainly a name, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, definitely. I definitely agree. And, you know, it would have been great to see Leslie Nielsen back as Frank Drebin. But, you know, he did get in on those Scary Movie sequels once David Zucker got involved there at number three. So he always dropped in and did his comedic bit, you know, the same kind of comedy he does here in the Naked Gun series. So it's not like we completely lost Leslie Nielsen. He did make those appearances and he was very good. He's probably the better parts of those.
I didn't even realize that he was actually in those Scary Movies. I'm looking him up now. He plays President Harris in those Scary. He did 3 and 4. I'm not too sure if he did kind of anything after that. I mean, the 4 was made in 2006. And when did he pass away? He passed away in 2010 at aged 84. So he did okay. But yeah, I didn't even realize that David Zucker kind of brought him on board for those.
Yeah, and he did have some of those funny gags, you know, like David Zucker and Pat Proff wrote some really good stuff, some really good sight gags like they did for Naked Gun. You know, there was one that always stuck out to me because, yeah, Leslie Nielsen played the president and he had this one gag where he had to deal with a crisis and he says, "I wonder what President Ford would have done." And then they pan over and there's this big picture of Harrison Ford up on the wall. I just thought that was really funny.
I'm just looking at, after these Naked Gun films got made, Leslie Nielsen certainly kind of fell into a bit of a category, didn't he? And like, he kind of went on after this to make not very many serious kind of films. I mean, he made a film called Dracula, Dead and Loving It, and Mr. Magoo he was in, and a few kind of other things. But
Spy Hard was one.
Spy Hard, that's right.
And that wasn't too bad. I really liked that. It was kind of like a spoof on the future.
Oh, man, don't misunderstand. Like, I'm not having a go at these films or just talking about the quality of them. I mean, to be fair, I haven't seen most of them, and I'm sure a lot of them would surprise me. But he certainly did get kind of typecast a little bit, especially after these films. Of course, I mean, they were so popular at the time. And, like, Frank Drebin is great, but he's certainly a bit of a buffoon, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, for sure.
This was O.J. Simpson's final film role. He actually won a Golden Raspberry for Worst Supporting Actor for the film. Keep in mind that the whole murder trial and the Bronco chase and all that kind of stuff happened the following year after this film was released. So this was done in 94 and all that stuff started happening in 95. And as we kind of mentioned in the last episode, I kind of think O.J. Simpson's been undercooked a little bit. I mean, I actually think he's not that bad. I actually quite find whenever he shows up, he certainly does his best, and you giggle a little bit. And I think for him to win a Golden Raspberry for Worst Supporting Actor for the film is a bit much, truthfully.
I think I said it in the last episode too, about 2.5, is that it seems like he's doing less and less each movie, which is saying something because he was in a coma for a good part of that first
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I know.
He just really just didn't show up that much. He had all of like 2 scenes at the beginning and then halfway through, and it was about it.
Well, don't forget, man. Yeah, that's that scene early in, I think it's in the first film, where Frank is talking to O.J. Simpson's wife, saying, you know, we're never going to stop. No one's going to stop, you know, before we get this guy in. Now let's get a bite to eat, you know.
Yeah. But O.J. Simpson does nothing in that scene.
He does nothing, I know.
Except get, like, folded in half on a bed.
The next bit of trivia is pretty interesting as well. Apparently there was a promotional image that was used for this film where Leslie Nielsen actually parodied the famous Demi Moore Vanity Fair magazine. Back in the early 90s, there was a very famous picture of Demi Moore nude, like 9 months pregnant,
yeah.
Bearing everything. And it was a very famous picture taken by Annie Leibovitz. Leslie Nielsen actually parodied that image for the release of this film, and Annie Leibovitz didn't really like it that much, so she decided to sue Paramount for copyright infringement. It was actually found out that Annie Leibovitz didn't win the case because it was actually considered fair use because of its transformative parodic purpose, which it kind of was doing. I mean, I don't think they were trying to... It was certainly very lighthearted, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. It's not that different from us doing a podcast here about this movie, you know? We're not infringing copyright law. We fully disclose that we are reviewing films and we are not infringing on any copyright because of that.
You know, this
is all critique purposes.
I did kind of find it interesting that, this kind of happened. I mean, this is 94, so Naked Gun is this before, like, South Park and all that kind of stuff? I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah, South Park would have come in 96 or 7.
Yeah. And we all know that they were very, they were all about pop culture. And I think I read somewhere that when South Park produce an episode, there's a really short turnaround. That's how they kind of get current events so prominently within the episodes. Like something will happen like a week or two before, and they'll be able to write and produce, animate, voice record an episode in a matter of days to kind of get it on air that next week. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, I do love stuff like that. All right, so as we mentioned, this one is not directed by David Zucker. It's Peter Siegel this time. And in addition to playing the producer of Sawdust and Mildew, which I don't know, is a random thing to call a movie, but he also has several minor roles in this film, and it's mostly in voiceover. He does the voice of the suicide bomber in the Untouchables parody at the beginning of the film. He does the voice of the K-Sad DJ, which is a great little voiceover. He ADR'd screams
nice
of the inmates escaping from a prison by
toll
boarding.
Right at the start of the film.
He actually plays the real quote-unquote Phil Donahue before Frank knocks him out and takes his place. And he also does the voice of the man shouting, "Stop the stairs, Joey,"
at the
Academy Awards. So.
Now, keep in mind, Peter Siegel is not a no one at all. I mean, he was kind of involved in that whole Tom Arnold, Roseanne kind of world. He produced a lot of like TV documentaries for Tom Arnold in the early 90s, late 80s. But then he actually went on to do, obviously, Naked Gun 33 and a third. He directed Tommy Boy, and that was with, wasn't that David Spade and Chris Farley?
Yeah, good movie. Very funny.
Is that right? Right.
Yeah.
He also went on to direct Anger Management with Jack Nicholson and Adam Sandler, Nutty Professor 2, 50 First Dates, Longest Yard, Get Smart, Grudge Match, which was that Stallone De Niro boxing film that should have been spectacular, and for whatever reason it just kind of fell a bit flat. But he also, something that I'm kind of interested in, that because he actually directed a TV movie recently called Ken Jeong Made Me Do It, and you know Ken Jeong from Community.
Yeah, Community,
yeah.
The Hangover movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he's very funny. He's quite a funny guy. So I think that's kind of one to look out for. So yeah, this is certainly one of his early films, and I mean, he's gone on to direct lots of kind of, you know, for better or worse, very interesting and quite successful movies. So, yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah, and I thought this one was great too. I actually went back and watched the scene, and it's actually pretty accurate. But apparently on the day of shooting the 1970s flashback, George Kennedy had actually come down with pneumonia. and he was so ill that he couldn't actually even walk. So if you watch the scene, George Kennedy's actually sitting on a stool the whole time.
Is he?
Yeah.
Because Frank kind of comes up with him, and they've got all this like jive talk, don't they?
Yeah, it's a stone soul gas and all that stuff.
It's a stone soul gas.
So George Kennedy's sitting there, and he immediately excuses himself from the scene.
Oh, wow.
And he's apparently supposed to like walk off scene, but again, you know, he can't actually walk. So he sort of leans out of frame, creates the illusion that he's walked off, but apparently he just stayed in the stool for that shot. And it's actually, yeah, when you watch the scene and know that, you're like, okay, yeah, I see how they kind of got away with that.
What else do we have too? El Bone, who he actually played, he was in Terminator 2 and Terminator 3. He was the psychologist for Sarah Connor in those films, and he actually plays a psychologist again in Naked Gun 3.
I was actually hoping that they would refer to him as Dr. Silverman.
Yeah, I know.
The whole time.
The cover of the issue of the Playboy that Pap Schmier, spoiler alert, that Pap Schmier's back, you know, he's reading in his Learjet, features Anna Nicole Smith, who actually plays Tanya Peters in this film.
I saw that.
Yeah.
There's the scene in the crime lab.
Yeah.
We got Ted back there, and he's talking about the paper that the note was on. And he says that it's the quote-unquote rare Canary Islands pine that was in the... he found in the paper fibers.
Yeah.
But actually, the Canary Islands pine is one of the most common trees in the world.
Isn't that the scene too where like Drebin is kind of picking up all this random stuff around the lab, and Ted kind of keeps like snatching it off him and sort of saying, that's exactly the name for this movie. Actually comes from long playing vinyl records, which LPs actually played a speed of 33 1/3 revolutions per minute. The original title of the movie was actually going to be Naked Gun 33 1/3, just for the record, but the subtitle was changed to The Final Insult due to fear that not all audiences would get the joke. Personally, Corey, I kind of wish they kept that in.
I know. It's like what we're just talking about, the rare Canary Islands pine gag. Like,
yeah.
Unless you know that Canary Islands pine are actually really common, you're not going to get that gag. So just go with it. Who cares if everybody gets it?
It's the Naked Gun, dude. It's a gag a minute. You know
exactly.
What I mean?
We're not making high art here.
No, they're not.
It's a spoof comedy, for Christ's sake.
Yes.
This is Raquel Welch's first film since the movie Animal, which she made 17 years earlier in 1977. She's a big celebrity. People know her, but she hadn't been in a film for 17 years before appearing in this film.
I actually don't really know too much about Raquel Welch. And I know she was a big star in like Barbarella and various films from the 70s, but I've never really explored any of those movies. Perhaps I should. She's famous for a reason. I'm not too sure if it's good or bad, but I should probably check them out.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a lot of classics that I've never seen, but you know what? I've seen all the Transformers films, but I should probably watch more classics.
Not enough time for that when you're watching Naked Gun films, man.
Yeah. Anna Nicole Smith passed away 3 years before Leslie Nielsen. Leslie Nielsen passed away in 2010, and Nicole Smith passed away in 2007.
You know, another brief cameo here. Anne B. Davis appears briefly in Frank's fantasy sequence, of course, doing a parody of her role from The Brady Bunch.
I know.
Hi, Mr. D. Hi, Mrs. D.
I was actually surprised at how many Brady Bunch references there were in this film, but we'll get to that as we kind of go on.
Exactly, because we also have an appearance by Florence Henderson.
I know.
Being nominated for an Academy Award, and I do love the line, you know, Florence Henderson's going to win, and it's about time. When they're actually bringing her up to be nominated for the Academy Award, she actually appears in the middle square there, and she looks left and right at the people next to her.
She does, actually.
Which I thought was pretty good.
Now, something, before we get to our main discussion, I just want to bring up something to look out for is when the credits roll in this film, don't turn them off. Watch them to the end, because there's some great gags that they kind of put throughout the credits. Like, they keep putting these like gag credits. Did you pick that up, man?
You know, I can't remember them all, but I did. I was reading them. I think one of them was like, geez, these credits are long, or something like
this
that.
This is what it says. Geez, these credits are long. There was like, no animals were harmed during this filming. However, some species did become extinct during principal photography. Species, cause of death. And it actually goes and lists like the And then it says stuff like too much makeup, Tammy Faye Baker, after Dolly Grip, hello Dolly Grip. This is like all these like really great gags that are well worth checking. I could go on and on and on, but yeah, like you should just kind of watch them. There's some great stuff.
I do love credit gags where you can get them.
Oh man, more movies should do it. After I was watching this, and I thought, you know, it's a pretty simple way to kind of get you sitting there the whole way, and it's good that they were quite from. Like it says, like after Grip, Kung Fu Grip, G.I. Joe. That's what it says.
All right, so let's get into our main discussion of the film, shall we?
Sounds good.
All right. So a bit of a cold open on this one, I think. And, you know, I'm going to say this from the get-go. I don't think this one is nearly as funny as the previous two.
Yes, I'm going to say that as well. I don't think I laughed nearly as often. I did laugh a few times, but yeah, nowhere near as many as two and nowhere near as many as one.
Yeah, I think this was, you know, once I realized that this was directed by someone else, like we said, Peter Siegel directed this one, it's like a facsimile of what David Zucker was doing, you know? And I think Peter Siegel doesn't quite get the timing right. So, you know, from a comedy filmmaking perspective, it's really interesting that you can have a different person behind the camera directing everybody and how much performances can change. Because we've gotten to know Frank Drebin a lot over the last two movies. And we know that Leslie Nielsen can give these comedic performances and his timing is really good and all that. But just that change of director does something to this movie to make it feel different.
It's like he's trying to be slightly more serious just at times. And I also kind of think too that they almost like outsourced this sequel. Like it's almost like they were possibly too busy at the time or for whatever reason. And as we said, number two was a big hit. It made a lot of money and it was very successful. And for this to be made 3 or 4 years later, they weren't rushing to do this sequel as well. So maybe it was possibly contractual. It's not impossible. And when they actually finally got around to making it, rather than kind of go with the team that kind of knew exactly what they were doing and how to kind of get the best out of the material and kind of pull all the gags in, I suspect they kind of outsourced it to a very capable director. I mean, don't misunderstand, Peter Siegel is clearly a good director, and this film is by no means a bad film, but it's not nearly as funny as the previous two.
Yeah, and like I said, it's a cold open here with this Untouchables parody. And was apparently written for the first movie.
Yeah.
And because of budget constraints and everything, they couldn't quite get it made. But they go with this Untouchables parody. It's a film that can be lost on a lot of people, especially now. I mean, I don't know how in the cultural zeitgeist the Untouchables was in 1994, but you know, here we are in 2016. I don't think a lot of people would have seen that movie, and they wouldn't necessarily get what the parody is all about.
Yeah, but like at the time it was big, but you're right. I wouldn't necessarily say it's kind of translated to like decades later. Like, yeah, you're right, man. I mean, the Untouchables was like late, you know, early 90s, I think it was. Kevin Costner and Sean Connery was in it too, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
And was a big hit, no question there. And yeah, they definitely kind of open this film with a parody. And this actually film is full of parodies, especially considering that there's an Academy Award kind of thing too. And something else that I kind of want to mention before we kind of go too far as well is, like, this is a $30 million film. The film only goes for, I think it's an hour and 19 minutes long, or maybe slightly more, 82 minutes long it is. The credits start after an hour and 12. It's a short film. Like, you can knock this one over pretty quickly. And like, the $30 million for such a short film doesn't feel like too much, does it?
No, exactly right. So, you know, the gags are still pretty good, but I think it's just the timing of it that just doesn't quite work for me. Because, you know, this opening scene is still pretty funny. They're, like, at this sting or something, they're waiting for, you know, this mob boss to come down, and there's suddenly this woman who has a pram, so Frank, you know, being the gentleman, is going to help her pull this pram up the stairs.
Yeah.
And then while he's doing that, Ed's off to the side dressed as a bellboy. There's a woman with two prams. So Frank's like, I'm going to have to help her.
Yeah.
He gets Nordberg to do that. Yeah.
Isn't he like selling hot dogs or something like that?
Al's at the top and there's a woman with a pram. So he's got to help her bring it down. So of course, while they're moving all these prams along the stairs, the mob boss comes down. And then they just let these prams go.
Yeah, and have this big shootout.
So they pull out their guns and start shooting hurting everybody.
I know. And you've got some really bad stereotypes in the world. I think there's a bit like later on in the sequence where like this, what looks like an Arab of some description with like a bomb kind of starts, runs in and yelling at the top of his lungs, and they just shoot him, don't they?
Yeah. And then the Pope comes out.
That's right.
Disgruntled postal workers, which is a very 1994 joke.
But again, I reckon this film is full. Like, we were actually talking about in the previous film about the whole idea of parodies, and they did Ghost, I think, in the previous film. And this film, there's a lot more of like jokes from the time that I'm not too sure too many people would kind of understand these days. Like, I understand it because I was there and I kind of have a vague understanding of the history of how this all works, and you do as well. But like, if you were 18, 19 and you've suddenly found this on TV late at night, I don't think you'd have any idea what was going on when disgruntled postal worker starts running out trying to shoot people.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all played off as a dream anyway.
Yeah, yeah. He wakes up in a cold sweat. That's right. It's actually a pretty good gag. And I think he wakes up and Jane says, "What's wrong?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm all wet." And he goes, "Oh, I'll go and get the talcum powder."
No, it's not that. Yeah. It's this whole thing that he's retired from police squad, right? Yeah. That's the whole setup for it. Jane kind of made him retire. They've gotten married. They've settled down. And she actually wants to have a family.
But it's revealed early on that Jane is this high-flying lawyer too, isn't she?
Yeah, like, where'd that come from?
Yeah, I know. Which I found really random. She said, I don't remember her practicing law in two films.
No, she was a secretary or something in
the
first.
I don't know what she was, but she certainly wasn't a lawyer. Maybe she was. I don't know. They certainly didn't really explain it, but they she's like this high-flying lawyer and isn't like it's actually a pretty funny sequence, actually. I didn't mind all the stuff with Jane in the court because isn't she I can't remember the actual case it was trying to do, but it's a jury full of like expectant mothers. Oh, that's right. And they're all trying to breastfeed, aren't they?
Yeah, they're all trying to breastfeed. And then the judge has like a 6-year-old or something.
Yeah, who's like playing and like being disruptive and causing problems and like hitting the hammer and all that kind of stuff. And as much as it's silly, I did giggle a little bit during that sequence.
Yeah, and I can't say I ever really remembered this. This is the one I've seen the least, for sure. The case she's actually trying is actually for her friend Louise, who she hooks up later with for the Thelma and Louise parody.
Yeah, that's right. And that sequence goes on for ages when they do the parody for Thelma and Louise. And again, if you were 16 years old now watching this film, you'd have no idea who Thelma and Louise were. Not a clue.
Exactly. So yeah, and this is kind of the thing, is that she wants to have a baby. It seems that her and Frank are having trouble conceiving.
Oh, that's right. They are. They're getting therapy. And I think that, don't they say something like at the start, like, thank you for taking us on so quickly after our previous therapist. And the guy says, yeah, I was really sad to hear about his suicide.
Yeah. He, because like we said, this is Dr. Silverman from Terminator, right? So he's sitting there and he says, you know, why don't you just make time for you? Just be Frank and Jane, the lovers, and it'll be great. And then they start doing that thing that they did in the last movie where they call them schnookums. Right. Dumpling buns and stuff like that. And he's just looking at them and he goes, Mr. and Mrs. Drebin, I'm a diabetic.
Doesn't he say stuff too, like to like spice up their sex life? And he goes, oh, have you tried lingerie? And Frank goes, yes, I've tried all that.
I've worn them all.
Nothing works.
But they're all set. They're going to have like a nice romantic night together. But instead, Nordberg and Ed show up at his door and they're doing this case about a bomber. They think terrorists are going to hit a high profile target and they need Frank's help.
It isn't Drebin, like before Nordberg and George Kennedy show up, isn't he like watching a soap opera, like ironing or something like that?
Yeah.
And he shows up at the door and like, he's really embraced his retirement, and he's all about like making sure dinner's ready for Jane when she gets home, and worrying about like dinner, and he's like, oh, I'm about to put a roast on. And then they try and entice him to go undercover for a short period, don't they? And they try and kind of sell it to him by saying, oh, it'll only be a few hours, like it's not a big deal.
Yeah, they've got intel that there's this woman, Tanya Peters, who works at a clinic, who might be involved with whoever is going to go ahead with this bombing.
Yeah.
And Frank recalls that they'd met Tanya Peters before back in the 70s. And that's where we get this random scene of them in the 70s talking jive and all that.
Yeah, that's right.
Which was really funny.
Don't they show up to the bar and it's like a disco dancer's being killed or something like that?
They actually pull a gag from the Police Squad series here as well. When Drebin turns around and there's Tanya Peters, Anna Nicole Smith, and he goes, "Cigarette?" And she looks at them and goes, I know. Which was a gag they did in, I think, every episode of Police Squad.
Really?
Where he would offer someone a cigarette and they just look at it and go, I know.
That'd be quite funny. You know what, man? Anna Nicole Smith, yes, I realize she doesn't have like a huge broad range, but she does okay in this film, I think.
Yeah, I mean, her purpose is to look hot. Really?
Yeah, I know, but she kind of... You're right, her purpose is to look hot, but she's still kind of given more than a few kind of gags to execute, and they're not bad. Like, she does okay. I think she does anyway.
And I do like the Nordberg gag of his giant hair as he's trying to get through the
Lord.
Door.
Oh, my Lord, yeah, yeah. And it's so big, it's not funny, it's ridiculous. I just love the fact that they've kind of all known each other for, like, 20 years. Like, they've all been on the force together, kind of fighting crime, you know?
Frank sort of gives them that tip, and they managed to entice him back into Police Squad. They're just like, well, there's like, we got nobody else, Frank. It has to be you.
I don't quite understand why it has to be him for some reason.
Like, it's like a simple explanation just to keep the plot moving.
Oh, that's
forward.
Right. We forgot about a gag earlier on, like that they do a flashback to Frank's retirement, and it says something like 3,000 people dead.
Yeah.
And he gives like a speech to say, well, it looks like I won't be shooting anybody anytime soon. And that is, unless of course I do have an intruder, and then I will shoot him, you know what I mean? Whatever it might be. And it's it's quite funny.
Yeah, well, he's turning his badge and his gun over to Ed, and Ed's just like, oh. Jade and I would like to keep the handcuffs.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
He's just like losing it, taking all this stuff.
So the Police Squad have caught wind that a well-known bomber named Rocco Dillon, who is actually currently incarcerated, has been hired by a terrorist who is Pap Schmier, known from the first movie, to conduct a major terrorist act against the United States. And that's when we meet Rocco Dillon, and we meet his mum. She, to me, is a very well-known actress, but I couldn't work out where I knew her from.
Yeah, I have a feeling like she maybe plays this kind of role a lot in movies. I originally thought she was the same woman who played, you know, the mobster mother in The Goonies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a different woman, but it's pretty much that same role.
Well,
right?
That's right. I was thinking the same thing, that it was The Goonies, but it's not her. The person who plays The Goonies woman is someone completely different, but they look really similar. But yeah. I'm actually just looking up her filmography at the moment, and she was in Gremlins 2, Teen Wolf 2, Inner Space, Dragnet. She was in The Blues Brothers. She was the nun that they kind of meet at the start of the film.
Right.
She's that. And I mean, she's been an actress since the 50s, very well known. So, and I mean, she's clearly very good at what she does. She actually passed away in 2001. So her name was Kathleen Freeman. And yeah, she was quite good. And she certainly does a good job in this film.
Yeah, and they do some good side gags of her coming in to see her son in prison.
Yeah.
She's, of course, brought Pap Schmier so they can work out the details. When she's walking through and there's all, you know, there's the plate glass between, you know, the people and the prisoners. And she walks past one, it's a fish tank.
I know, that's right.
Just a weird side gag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they work out this whole plan. Rocco has a high profile target. We're not going to know what it is until later, but he's getting prepared. He's going to bust out of prison and he's going to go after this target for Pap Schmier.
It's also made pretty clear that Tanya Peters, Anna Nicole Smith, is Rocco's girlfriend at the time, and he's like salivating for her, and he's asking questions like, you know, tell me how Tanya is, mom. And she's like, well, she's, you know, she's got a good bust and she's got, you know, curvaceous things and all that kind of stuff. And it's actually pretty
Jesus, mom, don't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm getting man cramps over here.
Yeah, that's exactly man cramps.
Yeah, so Frank's enticed back to go do this undercover thing at a clinic where Tanya Peters is working. And
oh, that's right.
This is one of the better gags, because he figures I'll fake an old football injury. So he's got his arm in a sling. And he does this whole thing about like, oh, I think I threw it out in the backyard with my uncle. I must have like pulled it too hard or something like that. And then it turns out it's actually a fertility clinic, and he's They booked him in for a sperm count. And it's when he goes, they go, oh, can you just come in this room to give us a sample? And he goes, oh, in there? And the nurse just goes, well, it's not exactly the backyard, but I think it'll do.
And, then they do this gag where whenever he's behind kind of closed doors giving his sample, and the room kind of goes crazy. Like, you hear things... You hear things like breaking and windows shattering and all kinds of things. And next thing you know, the door opens and he hands back his sample. And doesn't he have to give like several samples? Like, it's not just one or two.
Yeah, he just keeps going back so he can stick around and try to get information. And every time he comes out, he's like all disheveled and he's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
That's exactly right.
At one point, he asks for a hand and this like dominatrix woman goes in.
Exactly. And then they give him some like aid to kind of assist, which is like a porno. And he goes, yeah, he comes out, he goes, yeah, very informative kind of video, or whatever it was. It was very funny.
Do you have dances with wolves? It's funny. Yeah, but he finally gets into the file cabinet too, because he's, you know, he needs to get the information on Tanya.
Yeah, yeah.
And while he's flicking through the files, it says like, you know, the location of Jimmy Hoffa's body.
Yeah, that's right. The President Kennedy assassination. Yeah. The missing 7 minutes from the Watergate tapes, stuff like that.
And then the last one is like the address of Tanya Peters' lake house or something. But it's important because he actually gets a stick of lipstick, writes it down on his handkerchief.
Yeah, yeah.
And later he gives that to Jane. So yeah. It's not bad. I think that's probably one of the better parts of this movie.
So after Drebin kind of goes through the ringer at the fertility clinic, he actually goes back home to meet Jane, who in an attempt to kind of salvage their marriage has actually decided to spice things up just a little bit by buying some very exciting kind of lingerie. And she does this big reveal, and it's like this. It's got like fluoro stuff on it. It's got like arrows pointing down and everything kind of highlighted. And Frank is kind of doing anything he can to like not be in the mood kind of thing. And like Jane is kind of insisting upon them kind of getting it on. And doesn't he do this gag where like Jane ducks into the bathroom and he kind of opens his pants and pours some water down there, and like it just kind of, there's all this like steam kind of comes off his bits and pieces.
Here, I'll shave your back, like last time.
Jane, I really don't think we should.
Frank, what's this?
I fell on a rake.
You're lying. Now I know why Ed's been calling every half hour. You've been back on a case, haven't you?
No. I swear, it's another woman.
In your wildest dreams. It's bad enough that you won't have a baby, but I warned you what would happen if you went back to police squad. You white Anglo male.
Jane, it was nothing, Jane. I was only doing Ed a small favor.
Some retirement. I'm leaving, Frank. I never thought you'd go back on your word.
Aren't you being a little hasty?
I don't think so. That should be the cab. If you need to, you could reach me at Louise's. Oh, Frank, how could you? We need some time apart to think about us.
Well, I'm not going to think. Why should I start now? I love you. Look, baby, I am what I am and I do what I do. A few guys make shoelaces, some lay sod, others make a very good living neutering animals. I'm a cop.
Pretty speech, Frank, but my mind is made up. I'm leaving.
All right, then take this with you. Guess you know how my lips feel about things.
You're listening to KSAD. All depressing, all the time. And now here's a dedication to Frank from Jane, who just called from a taxi. And it reads, Frank, you lying weasel weenie. It's bad enough you're shooting blanks. Now you're leaving the door wide open, letting all the heat out. But you're born in a barn, you stupid.
Yeah, so like Jane notices the whip marks on his back.
Oh, that's right. And he says, oh...
It's another woman. But she's like, oh, I know you. You've been back on the job, haven't you? Yeah, you said you would give up police work. How dare you? He's like doing anything he can to make her believe it's another woman.
It was a total lie. It's very.
But again, I think the sight gags in this are really good, because you see Jane storm off into the bedroom, And then the door immediately opens again and she comes out. She's all like packed and she's got a trench coat on ready to leave. And then there's a ring at the door. She's, oh, that must be the taxi or that must be the cab. It's just like all this stuff happens just instantly.
Oh, no. So, yeah, it's very funny. And just like those sight gags. And, oh, man, there's some good stuff there. After all this kind of takes place and Jane leaves, it's decided that Drebin actually goes undercover at the prison to join Rocco in prison to kind of gain his trust and join the crew and do all that kind of stuff. And this is kind of, you know, there's some good gags in here, but it's probably not as strong as some of the other stuff.
No, I don't think so. It kind of slowly goes downhill here because he's in prison, undercover, trying to figure out what Rocco Dillon is doing. They do a couple of prison movie parodies here. Escape from Alcatraz, Shawshank Redemption's one of them. Spoiler alert for Shawshank, by the way, if you didn't know it was a prison escape movie.
Oh, that's all right. Okay. And doesn't he do all these gags about like they don't know what to do with the dirt, and it turns out that Frank is like playing baseball or something like that, and he keeps like letting off all this dirt, and they keep doing these endless gags of, you know, dirt just kind of showing up on the mound and huge amounts of it and all this and no one noticing, and some of it's funny, but it falls a bit flat a little bit.
They talk about this is the Escape from Alcatraz gag, is that they replace themselves with mannequins while they're digging it.
Yes.
Digging out of the cell, and it's just very obviously mannequins as the guard walks past.
I know, and no one kind of does anything like at all to try and stop them or that. And doesn't he give himself like some crazy pseudonym, like Frank McGurk or something like that? Isn't
it? Yeah, it's Nick the Slasher McGurk.
Oh, that's it, Nick the Slasher. And he goes, "Where's your number?" And he goes, "It's a private number."
I did actually like the guy who was originally in the cell with them too. His you know, prison changes a man. How so? I used to be white.
Yeah, that's right. So Frank joins Rocco in prison, and after winning his trust, the two stage their breakout together. Rocco even manages to persuade his dominant and highly distrustful mother, Muriel, who's played by Kathleen Freeman, to take Frank into their house, which is kind of a bit random considering they're experienced criminals and they're just taking this random person in. But actually, if I remember rightly, doesn't Rocco actually trust Frank? Because didn't Frank kind of help Rocco out in that prison scene when they're in the mess hall, and Rocco's trying to get like the escape plan or something like that together, and Frank distracts the guards and causes a riot, doesn't he? And doesn't he like eat the plan? Like,
yeah, he's going to eat the plan. It's like 3 pages, but then like when the prison riot breaks out, this guy carrying files stumbles a bit, so all these papers go onto the plan, so he's got no choice but to eat all this paper. And he's like shredding it and putting pasta sauce on it.
That's exactly right. It's so silly.
It really is a bit silly. And then while all this is going on, Jane goes off with her friend Louise, and they do this like Thelma and Louise bit. Yeah, a gag that's it kind of fell flat for me, the fact that they just like packed all this stuff onto their car.
Yeah.
Like, did you forget anything? Oh, I hope not. And they've got, like, everything on there. It was actually quite funny later, actually, where she comes out of the bar and just, like, a big plume of smoke comes from the exit. She leaves and is playing 99 bottles of beer, and she's all upset because they're playing our song.
That's right.
And as she walks over to the phone to call Frank, all these people in the background are nicking all the shit off their car. I thought that was actually a bit funny.
Why is 99? What bottles this song? I can only imagine.
A great little bit of ADR there. What song can we have play in the background?
They give Jane a couple of moments here and there, like throughout all the films, that are pretty funny. Like that moment's pretty funny, the 99 bottles thing. They do a gag in the second one where I think she's at some dinner and she storms out. And I think Quentin, who's the bad guy in the second film, comes out and she says, "What's wrong, Jane? What are you here?" And she's, "I was just trying to get some fresh air." And she's by this like dumpster that has fish.
Like running seafood.
Like a running seafood. I just want some fresh air. Then she spins this story about like, I'm from the sea, or like, and this reminds me of home, or something like that.
And she gets this bit where this guy like tries to come on to her, and she's like, "No." And he goes, "Well, when a woman says no, she really means yes. So come on, baby, lay one on me." So she goes, Yes. What do you mean, no? And this, she pushes him out in the street. He gets hit by a truck.
That's right. He does.
So she thinks that she's killed a man. So Lois is like, you know, yeah, you take the lead. We're going to go and kill all men. We'll go out on the road together and it'll be great. And again, it's another background thing because the dude ends up like standing up and he's like perfectly fine.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. That's very funny.
She ends up calling Frank.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the point that she finds Tanya Peters' address on the handkerchief, right?
Yeah, and it's like, she wasn't lying. It was another woman. That's what he says. That's right. He wasn't lying. She was another woman. It's very funny.
Yeah, so that's kind of bringing them together. So Frank has escaped from prison with Rocco. They're going to the Tanya Peters Lake House. Jane knows where they are, so she's going to go there as well. And
I had to get a message to police squad. This thing was turning into more than I could handle by myself. No phone and miles from civilization. My prospects look bleaker than a gerbil's in a bathhouse.
Who's down there? Slasher, have you seen my pigeon?
Pigeon? What pigeon?
What are you doing?
I'm just contemplating my next move.
Your bishop is exposed.
It's these pants. I usually wear a fuller cut.
You're all men. I like that in my men.
You're coming on to me big time, sister. You're praying like a kitten with a fresh mouse, but we got a problem.
We're Jewish?
No. You're Rocco's girl. And in my book, that chapter is called Look But Don't Touch.
I could have two lovers.
Kinky. But I like my sex the way I play basketball. One-on-one and with as little dribbling as possible.
You're tense, Slasher.
Well, I could relax a little more if I knew what was going on tomorrow. You wouldn't know anything about that, would you?
All I know is it's downtown and big.
That's the way I like it. What else?
Just this. What are you doing?
Well, thank you for the advice. I'll try that recipe out, Miss Peters.
How could you? Well, you just shove your tongue as far down his throat as you can.
They had this big confrontation kind of, you know, when she shows up to the lake house with Rocco and Frank and the mother and all that kind of stuff. And Tanya are all kind of there. And they have this like the almost like a domestic in front of everyone else. And no one can quite understand why Frank is kind of behaving this way. You know, it's quite good.
We don't spend much time at that lake house. But, you know, when they get there and there's Anna Nicole Smith and she's got this like pink bathing suit on.
That's right.
They do this like pan up the legs, which are just like ridiculously long, and they're doing like two sets of knees.
Yes, that's right.
Like, legs are so long.
I know. And it goes on for quite some time. It's not two sets, it's like three or four. It never ends.
But then the mother gets some good gags there as well, because they do the pan up the legs, and then the mother's just like, what are you standing around for half naked? There's no way to be. What are you wearing my bathing suit for? <That's>
So Jane follows the clue that leads them to the lake house, where she's promptly taken hostage by Rocco and his mother. Frank is actually barely able to save her life for the time being, and eventually Rocco actually reveals his plan to them for some random reason. The bomb is actually to be set off at this year's Academy Awards ceremony, with the bomb hidden in the envelope of the nomination of the Best Picture category, and it's supposedly going to get triggered when the card is pulled out.
Yeah, they even have this scene where they go and test the bomb, and it is just, it's not funny at all. The testing of the bomb scene, I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
They end it with a weird Beavis and Butthead gag.
I forgot about that.
It's blown up and the hair's all blown back, and Rocco goes, cool. And that's the end of the scene. I'm like, what the hell was that?
That's
like,
really random.
Yeah, it was random. It wasn't funny.
Yeah.
Like, ugh.
And you know what, man, if they're going to reference something, at least reference something kind of good. I was never a big Beavis and Butthead kind of guy.
Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't even like a parody. It was
really?
Just, Weird.
Wow, there you go. This is, I think, probably where most of the money went on this film, is the big Academy Awards ceremony, because they actually got quite a lot of stars. Like, we were talking, I don't know if we mentioned cameos earlier on. I think we did a little bit, but there's actually quite a few in this film. And Shannon Doherty shows up, Olympia Dukakis, Morgan Fairchild, Elliot Gould, Marielle Hemingway, Florence Henderson, James L. Jones, Mary Lou Retton, Raquel Welch, Vanna White, Weird Al Yankovic. Keeps showing up for some reason in these films.
I don't know why. I still find his cameos funny.
Yeah, and Pia Zadora. So I would expect that these actors probably, I mean, they wouldn't be giving up their time for free. They would be charging a fair bit, especially like James Earl Jones and
I know,
Elliot
right?
Gould and Olympia Dukakis. Especially those three at the time were pretty big actors. And yeah, they would have been charging quite a lot.
Yeah, I did notice too when they were doing the best supporting actress or whatever it was, the one with Florence Henderson, is that they keep naming all these weird movies about, like, you know, one woman's struggle of the death of her cat,
yeah,
set
right.
against the background of the Hindenburg disaster. Yeah,
that's right. I know.
They name like four actresses, but when you see the screen for just the briefest second, there's actually a fifth actress up on the screen. It's Courtney Cox.
Is it?
Yeah, they never mention her. She's not in the credits at all, but she's on that screen getting an award for whatever movie she was doing at the time.
Oh, my God. I actually read, so I don't know if it's actually him, but I saw something in the credits as well, that Paul Feig, F-E-I-G. Let me just Google it.
He's actually become really big over the last few years. Well, he's a comedy director.
Yeah, well, he's doing Ghostbusters.
Yeah, he's doing Ghostbusters. He does a lot of those movies with Melissa McCarthy.
Anyway, yeah, like he's credited in the credits, whether it's the director Paul Feig's another story, but I think...
It's definitely him. He's in the audience reacting to, like, the whole thing playing out. I actually do know him from some early roles in the 90s. He's in this great movie called Heavyweights with Ben Stiller and a bunch of the kids from the Mighty Ducks movies, about a bunch of kids at a fat camp. And Ben Stiller plays this, like, infomercial guy who wants to, like, really make them all lose weight, and he goes like freaking crazy.
Really
hilarious movie.
Wow.
But Paul Feig's in that too. He plays a camp counselor in that. So I do know the guy, and I spotted him in the crowd there while watching the movie.
Interesting, right? So yeah, so we've kind of gotten to the point where Rocco's kind of done his big reveal to Frank, and we've set up the stage for the what is essentially going to be the finale of the film. So at the awarding night, Frank and Jane separate from Rocco's team and frantically begin searching for the bomb, with Frank inflicting his usual chaos on stage during the prelude show, because he impersonates Phil Donahue, doesn't he?
I had to look up who Phil Donahue was, because I have no idea. Like, as much as we've been saying, like, there's a lot of references in here that people wouldn't get, I had no idea who Phil Donahue was.
I reckon this is one of the bigger kind of references that people just have zero idea. It's like saying that it's like, well, Phil Donahue was a talk show host at the same time that Ricky Lake was and all that kind of stuff back in, like, in Jerry Springer in the early 90s or late 80s, I should say, in early 90s. And he was ginormous, and he was a silver-haired guy, not that dissimilar from Leslie Nielsen, hence why they kept saying that he was impersonating him. So that's where they kind of got the Phil Donahue thing, and kind of, yeah, like, I get it. It's a joke for people that know, but if you don't know, it just falls totally flat.
Yeah, and they keep going back to it. You know,
they keep going back to it over.
Phil Donahue's ruining us. We shouldn't have Phil Donahue back next year. All that stuff. Nowhere near as funny as when they previously did this with the Enrico Palazzo bit.
Yes.
Which was way funnier.
It's Enrico Palazzo.
Like, I would have laughed harder if they referenced that. Like, just like if he comes on stage and someone goes, "Is that Enrico Palazzo?" I would have laughed my ass off.
It's so funny. Yeah, and now that you mention it, they should have done it totally. Oh, I'm laughing just thinking about it. Because in the second film, it's so well done and it's so random.
Listen to you, I've set you up now.
Oh, you have set me up. I totally forgot about Enrico Palazzo.
Yeah, but he comes out on stage and he has to present an award with Raquel Welch.
Back from commercial in 5 seconds.
Hurry up with the mic and cue Donahue in 3, 2.
Read it. Read the card, moron. Well, Raquel, this certainly is a special evening. Phew. I can barely catch my breath. Turn it over to Raquel. Raquel, I'm used to being out of breath, working out to my video.
What the hell is he doing?
Hold for laughter and applause to Phil. Gets me out of breath just watching you, to Raquel. Oh, Phil.
I'm supposed to read that.
But let's get to the subject at hand. Pick up the envelope.
The nominees for Best Director are
Sir Richard Attenborough for his musical based on the life of Mother Teresa. Mother.
Food! I love food, and I'm really in the mood for a big corn dog, a poo-poo platter, two ding-dongs, it doesn't matter. Handsome tuna helper, I'll be racing back for more. But don't add any salsa, because I'll blow chunks on the floor.
Wait!
Why a talk show host has to present with Raquel Welch is another story. The Best Picture, no less. Like, normally this is reserved for, like, Morgan Freeman or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Jack Nicholson. They had James Earl Jones up there.
God. Hey, speaking of James Earl Jones, I actually noticed in the credits that they thanked George Lucas because earlier in the film, don't they do a parody of Star Wars at some stage, like right at the start of the film, like in the opening?
With the police siren.
Yeah, with the police siren, which we haven't actually really talked about at all. I mean, I know we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but going back to the start of the film, yeah, they do like a bit of a spoof of the TIE fighters kind of going into the Death Star, don't they?
And here at the Academy Awards as well, they do a Jurassic Park parody, again falls a bit flat. This geriatric park, genetics gone haywire at a retirement home or something.
And it's just not that funny.
This giant old guy.
Yeah, it's just not that funny, is it?
You know, some of this stuff about, talking about upcoming movies and stuff falls a little flat. I honestly thought that the Sawdust and Mildew was probably the funniest one because it just sort of brought to mind, I'm like, what the hell is this movie even about? And of course, it's probably some artsy shit, so it's going to win an Academy Award. So.
I reckon this is where a lot of the budget kind of went towards, is these little spoof scenes, because they wouldn't have been nothing to film. Like, it would have been expensive to kind of stage all that and actually set it all up and make it happen and make it work. And they only go for like 30 seconds of the film. And like, if you're going to invest that much money in something, make sure it's funny. And the Jurassic Park thing wasn't that funny. Even all the siren gags at the start of the film, like it's quite extensive. Like, isn't there a bit at the start of the film where they're in like a hockey ring as well, and they get into a fight, and then they're in a pinball machine, and they're going around, and then they end up in the Star Wars thing, and they go into like a women's locker room, and all kinds of, and like all that stuff would have taken ages to film and actually do properly, and it would have been expensive.
And again, like, you know, just the cameos here, Elliot Gould, Raquel Welch, James Earl Jones, like, I know they're only little drop-in parts, but you gotta still pay these people to come in to shoot for half a day or something, whatever it was.
Yeah.
So, you know, a bit of extra money going out on these people. But, I did think this thing with Raquel Welch was actually pretty funny. The fact that he doesn't quite know what to do and they're telling him to read the teleprompter, so he just reads the whole thing.
Like, verbatim.
Even the stage direction ends up getting in a tussle with Raquel Welch because she's insisting on opening the envelope, of course. He has to stop her from doing it, so she's fallen all over the place. He ends up coming back out later and getting involved in a musical number where it's pretty much the same gag.
Yeah, that's right. And then somehow Rocco and the mum end up on stage holding people hostage. I think they're holding Jane hostage, aren't they, to be fair. And then there's all these gags between Drebin and Rocco to try and get the gun away. And they do all these gags as well with the audience kind of like ooing and ahhing about the mistakes that kind of Drebin does. Like, he'll get the gun and then he'll do like another gag and he'll give the gun back to Rocco. And the audience at the time is going, ooh, don't do that, and do saying stuff like that. And it's okay. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of this, the end of this film. All the Academy Awards have just felt a bit unnecessary, truthfully. Like, it didn't need to be the Academy Awards. It could have been anything, and you would have accepted it. Like, I think they've tried to kind of go a little too kind of complex, where perhaps they kind of didn't really need to do it.
You know, the fact that they end up in the rafters, and then Jane has to say this whole bit, and Frank's, like, caught up in the ropes behind her, but obviously they switch him out with, like, some sort of rope dancer or something.
Yeah.
Again, not as funny as when they did this gag before in the previous movies, like when they swapped them out with like professional dancers on the dance floor and stuff like that. Like, it was funny back then, but this it's lost on me. It's not that funny.
No, it's not. So,
and of course, Rocco ends up like falling down. He grabs the envelope, pulls it out, and then gets flung back up into the air into Pap Shmear's plane, and then the whole thing blows up. And it's kind of the end of it.
But not just that, he flies up into the plane, and Pap Shmear's on the toilet at the time, and he ends up like Rocco's goes through the plane, and he's. Head flies up the toilet, staring at Pepsi, and Pepsi turns around and says, "Rocco?" And then the plane blows up. And that's essentially where our villain dies. We don't see from him again. He's done.
Yeah.
Drebin has kind of won the day yet again.
Yeah, and Jane comes to realize that Frank is made to be in police squad. So that was his whole deal. He couldn't perform with her because she'd neutered him.
Yeah.
So now that he's back in police squad, he's all good. And then they get this one gag of him coming into the hospital, Jane's giving birth, and they stumble into the wrong room, and the child is African American.
Yeah, that's right.
So he thinks that Nordberg got in with Jane or something and goes to attack him.
And starts running after Nordberg. And then as they're running out, Ed and Jane kind of come out and go, you know, well, let's say hello to the new kind of baby. And he just runs straight past him, straight after Nordberg. And that's it. Credits roll. We don't hear from Frank Drebin again.
A very poor dismount on this movie. Just wasn't that funny anymore by the end.
No, which is a shame because I really like these films. I'm glad we chose these films to talk about. There's some good stuff in there. And you know what? Like, there's some okay stuff in this film, but it's definitely not as strong.
Yeah. So ratings recommend?
You know, I'd say what if you've gone through the first two films, I'd definitely watch the third one. I'm probably hovering at about, you know, 5.5, 6 Nordbergs out of 10. I think that's kind of where I'm at. I think I had more fun talking about it than I did watching it. Like I think we laughed more now than I did during the actual viewing of the film.
I think I'm probably right about where you are. I'm just like, I was thinking maybe just give it like middle of the road 5, maybe just tilt it to 5.5. Stone soul gases, man.
Nice one, man.
So yeah, it's a recommend. I mean, if you've seen the other ones, you'll still like this. There's still some funny gags in here, but like I said at the top of the show, this one isn't nearly as funny as the previous two.
You know what though, man? There's a couple of good gags in here. I definitely recommend watching it.
Yeah, exactly. Still recommend technically, but take or leave it really, kind of.
Exactly.
Okay, so our next episode, we've got a couple of announcements we want to make about what me and you are going to do next.
Yes. There's been some discussions in the background.
And this is, you know, still a little bit off, not too far off, but it'll be just a little while before we get into it. But we've decided we're going to get into Alien and Predator.
Now, keep in mind, this is not Alien versus Predator. This is Alien and the Predator films, all films that were made between 1979 and 2012.
Yes, and I think we might call it the Alien versus Predator rewatch, technically speaking, we're talking about all the films related to the Alien and the Predator franchise. So we're going to do it in order of release, because we think that's maybe the best way to revisit it, to get into this rewatch, to watch them as they were released.
Like, I kind of want to see how each film kind of affects each other as well, because I know that little kind of tidbits of information were kind of given out, like, you know, just without kind of going into too much detail, but I know that I think it was in Predator 2 they kind of gave some information about Alien. I remember at the time it was quite a big deal. It'll be interesting to see kind of how each of the films kind of connect to each other, and because they're very much a shared universe, aren't they?
Yeah. They've been tied together over the years. I don't think ever intended to be the same universe, but because of comic books and things like that, the two of them kind of got weaved together. So we're going to experience that in release order, like I said. So we've got Alien from 79, and Aliens 86, Predator 87, Predator 2 from 90, Alien 3 was in 92, then Alien Resurrection from 97, then we go to AVP, Aliens versus Predator, the first official film crossover in 2004, AVPR, or Aliens versus Predator Requiem, 2007, then Predators 2010, and then of course the long-awaited Prometheus in 2012. And of course, in production now, more Alien films. So just like Star Trek, We're going to get into those new ones as they come out as well. But for now, we've got these 10 in the order they were made, and really looking forward to getting into that.
Yeah, so am I, man. Because there's two of those films that I haven't seen. I haven't seen Requiem from 2007, and I haven't even actually seen the new Predators from 2010 either. Okay. So I'll probably save that for the rewatch and just kind of get into it then. So yeah, man, I'm excited. It's more kind of rewatch stuff for us, and it's going
to
be good.
Yeah, really looking forward to those discussions.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, so that's it for this episode of the Rewatch Podcast. Keep up with listener interaction by joining our Facebook page at facebook.com/rewatchpodcast. Follow the show on Twitter @rewatchpod and visit our webpage rewatchpodcast.podomatic.com.
And remember, as always, you can write us an email or record a voice message and send it over to therewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Also, if you've enjoyed the show, please consider giving us a rate and review on iTunes. That really helps us out. And you can also help support the show by heading to patreon.com/rewatchpodcast and make a monthly contribution as little as $1. So thanks for joining me for the full run here.
I know.
It's been fantastic talking about Police Academy and Wicked at Bernie's and Naked Gun with you.
I'm kind of glad I suggested, and they certainly lived up to expectations.
I guess I'll just say until next time, someone make a note. I don't think we should have Phil Donahue back next year.
Damn Phil Donahue. And cheer up. This is not goodbye. It's just I won't ever see you again.
The Rewatch Podcast is not associated with the copyright holders of these films, and no copyright infringement is intended. The use of any and all copyrighted material is only for parody, news analysis, critique, or educational purposes as provided in Title 17, aka Fair Use. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Copyright 2016, The Rewatch Podcast.
Hi, Rewatch Podcast listeners. I'm Corey.
I'm Tom.
And I'm Nathan.
First off, let me say that we have all had a blast doing the Rewatch Podcast. Every week, we put out another episode for free for you. And although we enjoy these discussions with each other, we truly do this for you guys out there in podcast land.
That's right, Corey. But we are here today to tell you about Patreon. Every week, there are costs involved in podcasting about film and television, including hosting and bandwidth charges, our own personal internet usage, and film or show rentals and purchases. So, we're asking you to become a Patreon supporter.
If you can afford as little as $1 to throw our way per month, it would really help us keep the lights on. And if you want to send $100 our way every month, we wouldn't turn that down either. But it's your choice, and we appreciate the support you bring.
As always, we strive to bring you the best quality shows we can create, and we hope that you enjoy them. So head on over to patreon.com/rewatchpodcast to become one of our patrons and show your support for the Rewatch Podcast.
And if we get enough patrons, we may even be able to produce exclusive content just for the supporters in the form of simply getting episodes before the main feed release, or even bonus film discussion episodes as a thank you for your support. The website again is patreon.com/rewatchpodcast.
Thanks, everyone.